From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always good to have an old friend on the show. And this is an old friend who goes back to his first film, the film American Pie, as director. He's back with his newest film. The film is an interesting look at historical happening. It's the film is Operation Finale. My guest is its director Chris Weitz. First of all, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you, Elvis. It's always good to be here.
And as we were just saying before we got started, you are kind of uniquely suited to make this movie in some ways, aren't you?
Probably more suited than I was for American Pie.
You say you were never a teenager. Okay, fair enough.
I never went to American high school. I never went to the prom, you know, but my dad, this is now focusing on Operation Finale, this film. My dad was a German Jewish refugee, left in 1933 when Hitler came to power, and he emigrated to the States. He joined the army. He went into counterintelligence, worked at the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA, and his area of expertise was the Nazi Party. And he wrote books about prominent Nazi officials when I was a kid or young person. And I used to help him with these books. I would be his kind of research assistant and organize his library and copy read his books. So I was deep into this stuff from a young age. And so I was sent the script of Operation Finale a couple of years ago. It's written by Matt Orton, a really talented young English writer. It's about the mission to kidnap Adolf Eichmann, who was the logistics coordinator, basically, of the final solution of the Holocaust. The Mossad sent a team of agents into Buenos Aires in 1960 to kidnap him, brought him back to Jerusalem for trial, and a trial which is addressed famously in Hannah Arendt's book, Eichmann in Jerusalem.
And also the play, The Man in the Glass Booth.
Correct, which is kind of, a parallel universe version of that. I don't think it's directly about Eichmann.
Not directly, no,
yeah.
But it's
right.
It deals with that, certainly. But
I confess I haven't seen it.
Well, something else then. Because I guess one of the things I was thinking about, and it kind of lends itself to the way you make movies in terms of, I guess, in terms of sort of character dynamics, there's so often so much of the quotidian going around.
Right.
And this is very much that. Rather than being about so much the high-stakes espionage of it, it's just the everyday of it, which in its way makes it feel like a play to me.
I think the devil is in the details. For me, I'm always very interested in the sort of everyday dilemmas of people.
I mean, even something like the Golden Compass. I mean, it comes down to, rather than the micro, that's the macro of it.
Yeah. It's funny. In some ways, this movie is a movie about proper document handling, because it's really kind of plot points hinge upon whether you can get somebody's signature and whether the flight plan for a mission is an LL flight has been filed properly. So there's always people running around with pieces of paper, which actually seems completely correct to the period.
It's so 20th century.
One of the interesting things about the hunt for Eichmann was that they didn't really have very good pictures of him. They certainly didn't have current pictures of him when they were looking for him in the 50s and the 60s. And of course, now you would just you'd Google it, and you'd know exactly who it was. But all kinds of risks had to be taken in order to get Eichmann out of his house so that the Mossad agent could take a picture of him. It could then be physically transported home. The film could be transported home to Israel from Argentina, looked at, judged, and still you needed to send an entire mission to make sure that it was him. So there are all kinds of things that are, in a way, sort of retro, but it's also very sort of current day in its preoccupations.
But it's also this thing that really interests you, too, and works its way through a lot of your work, both with your brother and on your own, is that the accretion of information is important to character building for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it is these little details of character and habit that I really like that actors bring to the screen, and also little bits of business that people do that I think are important to getting a sense of of the reality of things. So I think that the temptation with these, with thrillers and with historical thrillers is to paint with a very broad brush. And, you know, there's only really one moment in the movie when somebody famous walks on screen and kind of intones, and that's Simon Russell Beale playing David Ben-Gurion, which was great to have. But I think life is more in the, you know, as in a discussion about cheese or, you know, trying on uniforms.
Oh, barbering.
Yeah, barbering. You know, we've got what I hope will go as one of the great tense straight edge razor scenes in cinema. I'm trying to think of, I think there was, wasn't there a Sergio Leone movie with a straight edge razor scene? Yeah.
They've been, I think, almost all of them, but it's the treat. We're talking about the tonsorial with my guest, director Chris Weitz, whose new film is Operation Finale. You mentioned David Ben-Gurion. I want to ask you, casting actors to play, well, casting Eichmann, what's your conversation with Ben Kingsley, who's part Jewish, about this?
The conversation is, I think the key thing that we managed to agree on was that, well, for one thing, in just a sort of an everyday sense or a quotidian sense, that we weren't going to have him adopt a German accent. That was sort of a decision across the board that I wanted to make, which was that, you know, to go on the theory that people sound like themselves, that nobody speaks in an accent. In fact, nobody does think they speak in an accent. And that anything that we could do to sort of take down the scrims between the audience and the performance, we would do. Also, that he wouldn't be a sort of a stock Nazi. Of course, you don't. Nobody sort of seeks out cliche, but we wanted to avoid the sort of embodiment of ultimate evil in Eichmann. And the reason for that is that I think that in so doing, we allow audiences to kind of put it on the shelf as an object, as opposed to something that they're really interacting with, which is to say, you know, we'd like to think that these that the perpetrators of the Holocaust were in some way unique or especially damaged, that they were sociopaths and sadists, but in fact they were often normal people animated by ambition, careerism, and opportunism. And when the opportunity arose, they kind of joined the bandwagon. And that's really all that it takes to end up with what happened in Europe in the 1930s and 40s.
There's a chilling aspect to it that certainly has echoes with now, is this dynamic that Eichmann is able to create, that in effect he creates another Bund in another country 20 years later that is just as fervent and as it becomes a whole, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a kind of a chase that goes on here. And as much as we're talking about the quotidian, you're still dealing with the fact that he is a man of enormous resource and charisma and who's able to rebuild in some ways. I mean, that to me is the horrifying takeaway of all of this.
Yeah, well, is that what attracted you to it? Financially, he was at loose ends, but in terms of his...
Yeah, he worked a job.
Yeah, he worked at the Mercedes-Benz factory.
I was trying not to say that.
And relatively speaking, I mean, the Mossad didn't believe that it was him at first because they couldn't believe that he was living in such relative squalor. But the Germans who had escaped, the fascist fellow travelers, were a powerful faction that would pop up every once in a while within the government. Of course, the Argentinians had had their own fascist movement, like the Italians had. The Argentinian version,
a lot of them were still placed in government after.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They believed in church and state, so their particular fascism was really animated by a kind of militant Catholicism, and of course, eventually this was going to come to pass in the 1970s and early 1980s. There was a military dictatorship in Argentina, as you know, and they had concentration camps and they had tens of thousands of people.
And that's the awful thing, too. You were basically watching a rehearsal of what comes to be, comes to pass in Argentina in 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an article in the New York Review of Books, I think it just came out today, actually, by Uki Gonyi, who is one of the great chroniclers of the military junta and of the El Proceso, they called it in Argentina, of the sort of scouring of the country, pointing out that blood and soil, that quote, in the beginning, he points out that blood and soil was actually as a concept invented by an Argentinian. His name was Daré, and he was sent to Germany to study agriculture. But you know, that this kind of like of nationalism, racism, ethnic hatred is not is not unique to Germany. It's just a deep well that all of these various bunches of draw from.
But no, I mean, that's the other chilling part of it, because we feel, just in watching this, I was reminded of not only Argentina, but Chile and so many other places. But yeah. In Argentina, it's specifically motivated, as you were saying, by this almost weird sort of hatred of South Americans and trying to basically implant this kind of these Aryan sort of precepts into the country.
Yeah, I think everybody in their worst moment has some sort of notion of racial purity. And it's tremendously damaging to the national fabric of a place, well, like America, obviously, but Germany, Argentina.
But did you, I mean, as you were making it and seeing what was starting to come to pass here, it must have sent a chill through you.
It was upsetting. You know, we were, when Charlottesville, when the murder in Charlottesville happened, when the right-wing riot occurred in Charlottesville, we were shooting. And I thought, wow, this movie is actually a great deal more contemporary than I thought it was. And we really like to think that, you know, when you see guys marching around with torches, albeit tiki torches, proclaiming blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, it really sort of focuses your mind on the timeliness of all of these things. And I think that, you know, inevitably people are going to sort of call this movie a Holocaust movie, a World War II movie, but it's really not concerned. I mean, it's not totally concerned with that. It's also concerned with the possibilities down the line.
Well, I got to imagine that's what attracted you to it, that is really about social movements as much as anything else, and about that awful saw, those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it. I mean, and how that is so inextricably entwined in so many social movements.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's that. I think that there's also this sort of psychological dimension of the two people in a room, of Peter Malkin, Oscar Isaac's character, and Sir Ben Kingsley's character sitting in a room attempting to get one over on each other. So it's not just the bigger sweep of history, but the individual sort of encounter with trauma that Oscar's character is going through. That was really interesting to me.
We'll take a break. It's a pretty heady subject, but it's a pretty amazing movie. The film is Operation Finale. Its director is Chris Weiss, who's having a yawn across from me. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about the new film, Operation Finale. Its director is Chris Weitz. It's good to have him back here. I guess as we were talking about this too, though, again, I found myself thinking about this idea of just how do you reconcile the fantastic with the everyday? I mean, and it's weirdly both in fantasy films and the realistic films. I mean, we look at A Better Life, it's about the same thing, about going to these incredible homes to do this work and then coming back to this little place where you live and trying to find purchase in a world where unbelievable things are going on. I mean, it's kind of an incredible thing to look at and see as a through line in your work.
I'm really glad to hear that you see that through line. I guess it's there. I mean, I certainly didn't set out to do that as a piece with the other movies, but I do think it was the agents who were there, who were stuck in a safe house with Eichmann for 9 or 10 days, all reported this sense of deep gloom, almost like being in a horror movie, I suppose. It'd be that kind of atmosphere, because in part they couldn't reconcile all of the terrible things had been done that had been done with this somewhat unprepossessing looking figure, and that there was a sort of a metaphysical horror to that, that they wanted in a way to see someone who was more obviously a formidable villain. Of course, the apparatus of Nazism was incredibly formidable.
Well, that's a horrible thing. I was, when seeing the movie you just talked to, I was reminded of going to Auschwitz and just seeing the amount of thought engineering that went into the movement of people from one place to another and how things are handled. I mean, that's so horrifying. And just hearing Eichmann talk, you realize that it's just this mind that's using practical applications for the most horrific of things.
Yeah, his first area of expertise before the Final Solution really got into full swing was in the sort of one-stop shopping of getting Jews out of the country. Before it was about the extermination, it was about emigration. And Eichmann established a methodology and even a place for it in Vienna when he was supposed to Aryanize or de-Judaify Austria, in which a Jew would sort of a Jewish Austrian citizen would enter, you know, the building and go through various bureaucratic offices, and by the end of it, he would have been stripped of his money, gotten his exit papers, had his passport stamped, and was on his way out. Now, when the war started, it became difficult, if not impossible, to get Jews out of the country or out of the areas of Nazi control. And in fact, they found themselves in charge of more and more Jews when they took over Poland. There were 3 million just there. And so then you see the gradual refining of methods towards the end of extermination. But it didn't, what they did was this kind of almost disrupting of state offices towards this eventual end. But it was a multi-step process, right? So at first there were the mobile killing squads, the Einsatzgruppen, and vans, and the more kind of blunt force ways of killing people. They became more and more efficient and utilized methods that had been used for euthanasia on getting rid of other people who were considered unworthy of life. So what Eichmann did is not to be sniffed at in terms of his ability to cajole and wrangle all kinds of local institutions to bend to the will of Himmler and Heydrich and the SS overlords.
And that becomes implicit, too, in his comfort in Argentina, that he's been able to use those same powers of persuasion and being able to read a room and find its weakness to use those for his benefit as well. And that's, again, that's to see this battle of wills between these two people is really just kind of incredible to me. And I just want to have you talk a little bit, if you would, about the rehearsal process between Oscar and Ben and in those scenes.
Well, here's the thing with movies nowadays, you don't really get time to rehearse.
Did you not have that opportunity?
Nope. We had a table read, and then we went to it, basically. And I figured I figured it was going to be right because it was Oscar and Sir Ben, so I figured that no matter what, it wasn't anybody's first time at the rodeo, but I also kind of liked the idea that if there was going to be some kind of clash, it was going to happen on the first day on set. And of course, we'd met and we'd had meals and stuff like that, but we didn't work the material. The material had been worked beforehand. My notes were in theory implicit in what had ended up in the script. Sir Ben was letter perfect from the table read and really had no intention of changing the lines themselves. Oscar is perhaps a lot more kind of loosey-goosey inclined to improvise on the fly.
Sure.
But but when we shot that first scene between them, we just did it. And what I think it's either that I'm very lazy or that I had some essential faith in what happens in terms of chemistry in front of the camera that really matters. Like, so my brother and I have never been too keen on rehearsing for film. Obviously, it's hugely important for theater, but I think it all happens in front of the camera, and if you're lucky, it happens well. In essence, when those two are together, they're acting towards each other as well, the characters themselves, because each one is trying to seize control of the truth and the narrative. And Eichmann, see, here's where I think Hannah Arendt's sort of intellectual formulation of the banality of evil kind of falls down, because I think Eichmann was a tremendously ambitious, capable, and manipulative figure. He was a guy who was basically, he's like one of these guys who you find nowadays in some country that I will not name, who are sort of down on their luck, and then they get their chance to maybe make some money or get some status with the, you know, the guy who's the comer at the moment. And these guys suddenly who failed out of various things have their chance. You know, Eichmann first started in the persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses, not Jews. But then he decided to become an expert on the Jewish question. And he more or less pretended to learn Hebrew, never really managed it. It was a little too difficult for him. But
that is true then, isn't it, that he never learned it?
He never learned it. Okay. No, he had a few, he could sort of bluff his way through a few opening things.
Okay.
And he was not just a gray functionary. He was a very capable liar, you know. When it served him, he would say that he was born in Palestine, you know, to sort of elicit the, because there was a time earlier on when he had been, because you talk about strange bedfellows, when his office was willing to do what the Zionists in Palestine wanted to, which is to say, get Jews out of the country and into Palestine, right? He was willing to work to achieve this goal, the goal that he had of kind of meeting his quotas with pretty much anybody. And in doing his business, he was very creative, he was very ambitious, he was deeply manipulative, and by no means just a cog.
Well, let's call this optimism for my guest, Chris Weitz, whose new film as director is Operation Finale, is The Treatment. Because what's happening here, though, and this, it's a bit unique to this film, is that there's an actual clock in this one. I mean,
right.
And that's something you hadn't really done before.
Right.
And you have this idea where the real plot is the fact that there's a movement towards a goal at a certain time.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was, in logistical terms, something that you wanted to do because you hadn't really done it before.
I'd never really done a thriller before, and that seems to be one of the things you do. It's a sort of a genre.
Really?
Genre trope.
Is that what this was?
They tell me. I think that this film needed to have bells and whistles of a genre variety, because I think it was important to make it entertaining, first of all. I wanted to make it a popular film. So did MGM. And in any kind of mission film, I think it behooves you to have sort of a ticking clock, a sense of imminent peril.
But I'm asking what it was for you about this.
For
because
me.
I know in terms of the tropes of those things are extant, but this is something that you were coming to for the first time, really.
This is something I was coming to for the first time. And I think I liked the idea of wrapping all of this heady stuff we've been talking about in the shape of a thriller. That was interesting to me. I always like, if possible, to do a different genre from the last one I did. And so this one, being a sort of historical thriller, really appealed in terms of what I'd have to learn how to do in terms of storytelling, and how to sort of bring it all together, if not on always on the page, in the editing room as well, the sort of these issues of pacing that you encounter. And then how to do that without hitting all the same story beats that somebody else has done before. I mean, in a way, so we have a not dissimilar structure to Argo, right? Which kind of I found I was haunted by, because I didn't want the end of the movie to be just like Argo. Inevitably, it has to be, because a bunch of people escaping from an airport while other people are trying to stop them. But it was interesting to me to try to do that where the stakes were all emotional, and the explicit stakes are life and death. But to me, the real stakes were emotional. Like how to make it about the relationship between Oscar's character and Melanie's character, rather than, are the Nazis going to get them or not?
Because with a thriller, you have to decide where you're going to put emphasis.
Yeah.
And there's so many scenes in this movie could be turning the movies in themselves. I mean, the entire movie could be could be Oscar and Sir Ben in the room.
Yes.
And I just wondered, for you, when you saw the script, there's so many points that could have been points of departure for other stories, how you decided to play San Francisco. Because, again, as much as this is a thriller, there's also historical import right. that you want to get across.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a nesting doll thing. On the outer shell is the historical relevance of it and the extreme danger, and then you get to the mission inside, and eventually at the core of it is the private story of Peter Malkin, who is kind of our touchstone. But we are sailing very close to the wind in terms of handling all of these really interesting stories and picking and choosing what to concentrate on, and still kind of make it a bit of a ride, as well as handling all of the details.
Because this idea of, for me, having so many big stories in what is in itself a big story, mm-hmm. that idea of finding the balance for all this is the interesting sort of nut to crack, is it not?
It is, and there were sort of subplots that were dropped along the way.
Oh, were there?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there was a further scene with Sylvia at one point in which she's told that she is Jewish, and she understands for the first time the situation that she's in. But I thought, I have to get to the other stuff first. So sometimes I think it's about meeting the story after some of the things have happened that you would expect to concentrate on. You know, it's an interesting, as we find that a lot of the best stories are now being told on streaming services to be viewed on laptops, I find myself thinking about this and how movies have about 2 or 2.5 hours to get their work done. They have to be kind of spring-loaded machines. And that's, on the one hand, a bit sad, because you don't always get the time to dwell on all the things that you want to, but it also allows for a real puzzling out of what is essential to the narrative.
That's really fascinating, the idea that movies really have to now be much more efficient to combat the kind of largesse that is the stock in trade of every other idiom nowadays.
Yeah, I think it's here. Now it's our business to somehow shift the furniture within the audience's mind within a couple of hours, and to provide a different experience from binging. One that it does sort of take them in a dark room. It takes them to another place for a while, and then sort of shoots them out. It's like a DMT trip, as opposed to, you know, when I do love how great TV shows are. But, you know, you're sort of laying down in your bed, and then you sort of go get a whatever piece of toast, go to the bathroom, come back. It becomes a little every day, as you say.
Well, on that note, the idea that movie theaters don't yet provide toast, we will wrap this up, and I will thank my friend and our guest, Chris Weitz, and his new film, Operation Finale. Again, Chris, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis, very much for having me.
My pleasure. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Newell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I am not in the mood for toast. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.